Hi, everybody. Welcome to Fireside Chat number 261. Now, you're probably wondering, why didn't I ask Megan 2 what number it was? Because I remember last week was 260. It's not impressive, but I just thought I'd share that with you. This is Snoopy. As many of you know, Otto, for reasons that only the good Lord above knows, has, in the last couple of months, pretty much opted out of his traditional role. I don't know why, because it's hard to read a dog's mind. If you think it's hard to read your spouse's mind, whew, this is a bigger challenge. I'm Dennis Prager. This is the Fireside Chat. And just to recount, it is truly spontaneous. I offer you some thoughts. It's really you and I. And then I take your questions. And it's a delight to do every week. So I always begin with some thoughts, and I have been writing in my weekly column, which I invite you to read. There are literally 1,000 of them on the internet, and I don't think any of them are dated, so pick any one you want, and I think you'll read a second, and maybe you'll end up reading a few hundred. I put a lot of thought into the weekly column. So I've started a series called What is Conservatism? The word is used a great deal, it's attacked a great deal, and it's used positively a great deal. But if you ask almost anyone what is conservatism, you may not get a truly coherent answer. People feel it, people who are conservatives, they feel that they're a conservative, but they may not be able to articulate what it truly stands for. By the way, this has been the great problem of religion and of America and of the West in general. Parents and teachers did not communicate what these things stand for. And if you don't, you will simply lose it. So, for example, American parents didn't teach their kids what America stands for. Of course, I'm generalizing. Some did. Christian parents did not truly explain Christianity. Jewish parents did not truly explain Judaism. And then they wonder, and often these are wonderful people, but they wonder, gee, what happened? Why is my kid disinterested in any of these things? You have to articulate what you stand for. My life has been devoted in large measure to explaining what people don't explain. All these values. That's the reason for my series on the Bible, the Rational Bible, to use reason to explain the first five books, the major books of the Bible, as an example. So what is conservatism? So the first and foremost thing is liberty, freedom, that the individual be free. What does that mean, though? Obviously, it is not free to murder, free to steal. What does it mean? It means that you are free within the bounds of morality, obviously, to do what you want and to say what you want. The greatest freedom is freedom of speech. Because if you can't say what you believe, you are reduced as a human being. It is an assault on human dignity to deprive people of the right to express themselves. It's truly evil and it's truly common. It's happening in America today, for the first time in American history, that people are being deprived of freedom of speech. I can't tell you how disturbing that is. I don't want to disturb you. Well, I take that back. I do want to disturb you. I don't want to depress you. I think that's the distinction that I'd like to make. The United States was founded with the emphasis on liberty. It is the dominant word. Give me liberty or give me death, one of the founders of the country, Patrick Henry, said. Everyone my age learned this by heart. Every American learned it by heart since the 18th century. I would say that the number of young Americans who know this phrase today is probably one out of maybe 50. That's a perfect example. If you don't know give me liberty or give me death, did you know what? I'm curious. Had you heard that phrase? Did you learn that phrase? but did you guys go to regular public schools? No.
I did.
Yeah. You did? And you learned it at your regular public school?
Yeah.
Where'd you grow up? In Oklahoma?
Northern California.
Northern California. You learned give me liberty or give me death? Well, that completely undermines my entire opening comments. Maybe it isn't 1 out of 50. I don't know. It is an interesting question. It's worth bouncing off young people that you know. Whether it's known or not, we have not taught the value of liberty and how precious it is. Since I've spoken at Fireside Chats about the fact that liberty is not what people yearn for, they yearn to be taken care of, which is a loss of liberty. Taking care of yourself is one of the great freedoms of life. I can prove it to you very simply, because what is it that people who get old most fear? That they will become dependent upon others. They won't be free to have the dignity of taking care of themselves. So isn't it interesting? The thing people most fear, that others will take care of me, is exactly what people want. They don't want a nurse, perhaps, to take care of them, but they want the state to take care of them. It's an irony, isn't it? The thing people most fear is also what they most want, to have somebody take care of them. Anyway, I've talked about that and the loss that we're experiencing today because of the anti-freedom forces. They're called progressives, and I don't know what is progressive about the loss of freedom. It's a strange term, but I'm going to leave that aside as well. So that's the number one aspect of conservatism. And let me make something clear. Liberty is individual. There is no other definition to the term liberty. It means individual freedom. Group freedom doesn't make any sense. It is individual freedom. You are free to say what you believe. You are free to vote the way you want. You are free to read what you want, all within the obvious bounds of not being able to hurt another human being. Okay. So I'd like to talk about another aspect of conservatism that is almost never talked about, but it is what the word actually means, to conserve. What is it that the conservative wishes to conserve? This is big. We wish to conserve the best of the past, the best literature, the best art, the best ideas, you name it. That is what the conservative wishes to conserve. The non-conservative, the more you go from conservatism over leftward, that's my left, your right, as you're watching. So leftward, if that makes it easier. The less people wish to conserve from the past. This is a really interesting subject, one I have not dealt with. I haven't even dealt with, really, on my radio show, which is my laboratory of ideas. So there is the individual who wishes to conserve the best of the past, and then there is the individual who is infatuated, intoxicated even, with, are you ready for the word, the new. Or the favorite word, change. The further left you go, the more the desire for change, indeed, ultimately to revolution. So, no conservative is against change, providing, and this is big, the change is for the better. No conservative is against the new, providing the new is also better. So if you have, oh, let's take my favorite field, music. So if there is new music that is beautiful, wonderful, inspiring, happy, whatever it is about music that you like, not an issue. But we also want to conserve the greatest music of the past, whether it's in popular or jazz, or country and folk music, or of course my favorite, classical. I love Beethoven and I love Bach and I love Haydn and all of these great composers, not because they're old, but because they're great. I don't care if it's old and I don't care if it's new. I care if it's great. I'm spending all these years writing a commentary on the first five books of the Bible called, as many of you know, the Rational Bible. Why am I doing that? Because they're the greatest ideas that have ever been written. I'm not intoxicated with the fact that they are old. It doesn't appeal to me, and it doesn't repel me. I don't care if something is old or if something is new. I care if it's great. So aren't we depriving the next generation of their birthright to have the best that humanity has ever developed? The finest art, the finest literature, the finest music, the finest ideas? Why is it important to give them new if the new isn't any better? I've never gotten an answer to that question. New is fine if it's great, if it's better. Now you'll say, well, how do you know if it's better if you don't experiment with it? Fine, experiment with it. I don't have a problem. I only have a problem with throwing out what is great just because it's old. That's absurd. If the finest ideas, literature, music, art are from the past, which makes sense, they have survived generations of testing. So they must be pretty terrific. I'll give an example of non-classical music, Frank Sinatra. And I use Frank Sinatra because I know a lot of young people are familiar with, you're familiar with Sinatra? Are you familiar with Sinatra? Okay, so it's a perfect example. You're both in your 20s. Now, that's very rare, by the way, that a popular singer will be popular for another generation after he or she has died. That's not common. So it's clear that Sinatra is so great that he and his music survive generational change. I'm not thrilled with change. I'm not anti-change. I'm pro-great. Why wouldn't we want to give, and this is what all education was, it was to give the best of the past, the stuff that has withstood the greatest test of all, time. There is no test like time. If something survives time, it must be pretty powerful. And that's exactly the case. So before you give the new, you've got to give people the best of the old. Then you can experiment with the new all you want, but at least learn what was great, what is great. And that's what we believe in conservatism. We want to conserve the best. In American terms, the Constitution is great. We want to conserve it. In the New York Times, the mouthpiece of the progressive left, you have now increasingly opinion pieces calling for the end of the Constitution. You really have the hubris to think you'll make something better? Has this not served or passed the test of time, making the freest country the one that more people have wanted to move to than any other country in the world? Isn't that a statement about what a success that Constitution has been in preserving liberty, giving opportunity, enabling affluence? So that's what we want to conserve, we who are called conservative. We have nothing against the new. We have something against the inferior. That's the point. The greatest gift you can give to your child or to your student or all of us to the next generation is the best that people have come up with. That's the greatest gift you can give them. If they learn the best and then wish to add to it, that's terrific. But it's not easy, by the way. It's very easy to come up with new. It's very hard to come up with better. So yes, I am proud to say I am conservative. I wish to conserve the best that humanity, and I mean humanity, if some of the best ideas or art or music have come from another culture, I want it. I mean, think for example about the great literature that people read. In Japan, they read Shakespeare. one of my dear friends who was 40 years, oh, what was he, 20 years older than me. And I knew him when I was 20. He was 40. And I used to visit him in Israel. He was an Israeli who was involved in the theater in Israel. And he translated Shakespeare into Hebrew. Now, that's a different culture. Why would they read an Englishman from hundreds of years ago? Because it's great. When the Department of English at the University of Pennsylvania took down Shakespeare's mural, they decided that there was something more important than great literature. And that was the ethnicity, sexual orientation, and sex, or gender, as they now say, of the individual. That is the worst possible idea. Shakespeare wrote the best that anyone writing English wrote. So therefore, the mural of Shakespeare at the Department of English makes perfect sense. But they took it down, and instead they put a picture of a Caribbean or a Latino female gay poet. Because her poetry was as great as Shakespeare's literature? No, because she was gay, female, and non-white. So that's an admission. We have no interest in conserving the best of the past and giving it as a gift to you at the University of Pennsylvania in the English department. We have no interest in giving you great literature. We have interest in giving you what people write who are of a different color, different sexual orientation, and not male. Do you really think that that is a favor to young people studying at the University of Pennsylvania? Of course you don't. It isn't a favor. It's what we call woke, which is the antithesis of excellence. We want to conserve standards of excellence. Is that so bad? Okay. And now to thine questions. And we begin with you. Okay.
Hi, Dennis. My name is Kira Bowlby. I am 21 years old and I am from New Mexico. My question is, what are your thoughts on people who say that pro-lifers are just a bunch of extremists? And what advice do you have on countering that argument that pro-lifers are a bunch of radical extremists?
This question is a little depressing. I'll say why it's a little depressing. It proves that if enough people say anything, people start to believe it about themselves. If a society says you're an idiot, you will start to believe you're an idiot. Or you'll start to wonder, am I an idiot? Even though you might be extremely bright. I don't understand why it's extreme. I literally don't understand. I don't use I don't understand as a euphemism for I don't agree with. I don't understand what is inherently extreme in saying that the human fetus has a right to live unless it threatens the life or health of the mother carrying it. What is extreme about that? Wouldn't it seem to me to be, if you were to use the term extreme, isn't it more extreme? For any reason you want, you can extinguish the human life that you're carrying? Why isn't that extreme? I mean, it's not the term that I use when I speak about this issue, but if you wish to use the term extreme, I don't quite understand why it doesn't apply to the people who think, kill it for any reason you want. You're not comfortable having a child. You didn't want a child now, whatever the reason might be, and it has no worth. But if you do want it, then somebody who actually does take its life is arrested. How do you explain that? If a mugger comes to a woman who is pregnant and shoots the woman in the abdomen and the baby dies, he is arrested for homicide. Homicide. That's the charge. But if she wants to kill it, it's a non-issue. So I don't understand. The it doesn't have any worth if the woman wishes to kill it, but it has infinite worth if she doesn't want to kill it. That's not extreme. So I would have to hear from somebody on the other side to explain why the belief that the child has a right to life is an extreme position. If it's an extreme position, see our video made a number of years ago about how European countries look at abortion. The United States of America has had the most radical, talk about extreme, the most radical positions on the availability of abortion of almost any country in the Western world. In France, as I recall, you want an abortion, they tell you to go home. You may be able to get it, but they don't give it to you when you want it. They want you to think about it, and they don't allow it under every circumstance. That's France, because people understand there's a person in there, certainly when it's viable. I mean, that's incontrovertible. So that's why the question saddened me that you, who I assume have a pro-life view, wonder how do you counter the argument that it's an extremist position. I'd like to know what's extreme about it. Okay, here we go. Thank you, by the way, Kira. Stanley in Alpharetta, Georgia. You often say the United States is the freest nation to ever exist. I believe that is true, but I have family members who do not. What do you mean when you say freest, and how would you describe that to someone who takes for granted the freedoms we already enjoy? Okay, so the issue of taking for granted is quite separate from the issue of is it freest. Yes, it has been the freest country in the world. Most countries would acknowledge that. Just a few years ago, when the Chinese living in Hong Kong protested the takeover by communist China of Hong Kong, meaning that they knew that they would start losing their freedoms, just as the Chinese people on the mainland of China have lost their freedoms. You know what flag they demonstrated with? What flag? There are 200-something nations in the world. Why did they choose the American flag? These are Chinese young people in Hong Kong demonstrating with one flag on behalf of freedom, the United States flag. Why did those who made the Statue of Liberty in France give the United States the Statue of Liberty? Why didn't they give it to any other country? Because this has been the freest country in the history of the world. Not now. I am amazed that I'm saying this. This is not the freest country at this time. I don't know what I would call the freest country, but I certainly wouldn't say the United States today is. Wherever the left has ever taken power, from the Russian Revolution to your local university, it has suppressed freedom. There's no such thing as left and free. No such thing. There's liberal and free. There's conservative and free. But there has never been left and free. The freest country means freedom of speech, as I explained in the beginning. First of all, you asked what it means. It means freedom to choose the life you wish to live. Was every American free? Of course not. Freest doesn't mean perfectly free. It means more free than any other place. And that has been true. Will it be true in the future? I don't know. That's the tug of war over America today, between the left and the non-left. David, 22 years old, Newtown, Connecticut. You have said a lot that it is important to protect the innocence of children. What exactly do you mean by childhood innocence? I've always thought losing your innocence is when you lose your virginity by having sex for the first time. Well, that's hardly the only way to lose your innocence. And I'm not even sure that it's the most powerful statement of loss of innocence. If you've lost your virginity for the first time with the person you're marrying or married to, you're still pretty innocent, to be honest. I mean, you're not as innocent as you were when you were 8 years old, when you didn't know what sex meant. But anyway, the loss of innocence is generally associated, that is true, with sexuality. And when you prematurely sexualize a child, just talking to them about it, let alone showing videos about it, you have shattered the child's innocence. A child's innocence can be shattered by violence as well. If a child, God forbid, sees a parent shot by an intruder into the home, that child's innocence is lost too. Its innocence is not just sexual. It has to do with not being aware of certain things about life until they're ready to be, like evil and like sex. Sex is not evil, of course. It can be. Everything can be evil. But evil is one example, and sex is another. We are not we. The left is prematurely sexualizing children by even talking to them about it when they're 5 years of age. It is an astonishing development that you can fear today for the first time in American history that by sending your child to kindergarten or first grade or second grade or third grade, you are risking your child losing his or her innocence because of the sex talk that will take place in school. It's almost beyond belief. Monica, 33, San Francisco, California. Dear Dennis, I've been a divorced single parent for the past 10 years. So from 23 to 33. I really want to remarry, but I know I'm getting older, and most people aren't looking for a 30-something single mother to marry. I'm feeling a little discouraged and not good enough. I know you've been remarried. How did you deal with feelings of failure and inadequacy after divorce? How did you have the courage to keep looking for a spouse? How did you know what to look for? And how did you trust yourself to know what to look for after your first marriage failed? Were you ever worried about a subsequent partner being unable or unwilling to form a bond with your son? Thank you so much, Monica. A lot of questions in there. Let me begin with number one. Let's see. Most people aren't looking for a 30-something single mother to marry. I hear that a lot, and it's probably somewhat true, but as a man, I don't relate to it. I married a woman with two sons, one of whom, by the way, is autistic. And I knew, therefore, that if I married her, he would be living with us my entire life. He's very easy, as it happens, but nevertheless, it means that somebody is in the home at all times. But I loved her. And I'm a big fan of using reason and logic. Really big fan. I'm very mind-controlled rather than feelings-controlled. I have very deep feelings, but they don't control me. And so my mind said to me, it's not easy to find a terrific woman. It's not easy to find a terrific man. I found a terrific woman. And so if she comes with two kids, including one who will live with me till I die, so what? Two of my favorite words in life. So what? I got this fantastic woman. What's more important than that? I don't understand men. Men will throw away a terrific woman because she has a child? That's not logical. That's emotional. And you're supposed to think logically. Okay, that's my answer to that part. I'm feeling a little discouraged and not good enough. Well, you are, whether you're good enough or not has nothing to do with the fact that you have a child. You may well be terrific. You can be terrific with a child and not good enough without a child. How did you deal with feelings of failure and inadequacy after divorce? Everybody feels that after divorce. It's inevitable. And then you move on. What else can I say to you? It's a normal feeling. It's a failure. Everybody who divorced feels that it's a failure. I did. I wanted to be married to one person the rest of my life. It didn't happen. Okay. Not everything you want happens. It doesn't make you a failure. And you then do the best you can under the circumstances in which you find yourself. How did you know what to look for? Man, I knew what to look for. I will tell you that. Okay. And how did you trust yourself to know what to look for after your first marriage failed? Well, by the way, just for the record, the marriage failed, it doesn't necessarily mean I failed or that you failed. Maybe you were a terrific wife, and for whatever reason, it didn't work out. I was pretty loving and a good husband. My late wife, whom I divorced before she died, but she has passed away, she had very, very terrible issues from being molested as a child, which ironically came to the surface more when she got older in life than even when she was younger. I don't blame her, and I don't blame me. There's a lot of tragedy in life. You might have been a great wife. I might have been a great husband, and it still happened. Were you ever worried about a subsequent partner being unable or unwilling to form a bond with your son? So that's a very interesting issue. It did not occur to me. Of course, I wanted my wife to have a bond with my sons, as it happens, two sons. Of course, that was an ideal, but it wasn't a deal breaker, and it didn't preoccupy me. Some step parents have great bonds, very, very tight bonds with your child, and some step parents don't. So it depends on the age of the child. It depends on the nature of the child. Depends on the nature of the step parent. And that's not what I was looking for, a wife, not a stepmother. I guess that's a way to put it. She turned out to be wonderful in that capacity, but that wasn't the preeminent aim of my remarrying. All right, I hope that helped. How are we doing on time?
We're out of time.
Oh, I always get disappointed when we run out of time. It's a very fast half hour we have on a fireside chat. Well, conserve what is best. That's the obligation of every generation to the next one. We're going to give you the best that people have ever come up with. You want the best of the past? The best thing ever written is the Bible. It's the basis of the West. My latest volume of my commentary, third volume, Deuteronomy, the Rational Bible, is out. I think it'll deeply move your life. See you next week. Thank you for watching this video. To help keep PragerU videos free, please consider making a tax-deductible donation.